spiral stairs before she can see the tears in my eyes.
Erin. Snoop ID Little Mai. Listening to Offline. Snoop Scribers 10.
When Liz's footsteps disappear along the corridor, I slump back in my seat with a sigh and run my hand over my face. I'm sorry. I don't know what possessed me to say that, except that out of everyone here, it's Liz I feel most sorry for. I'm not even sure why exactly. Maybe because it was so plain right from the start that she never wanted to be here. Topher, Ava, however awful this weekend has turned out to be for both of them, they brought it on themselves, in a way, choosing to come here, brandishing their money, pushing people around like little chess pieces in their battle for control of Snoop. But Liz is just a pawn, like me, caught up in something she never asked for, never wanted. And yet not once has she complained. Where Topher has grumbled about the crap food, and Carl has stamped and roared and threatened legal action, and Rick has blustered about health and safety and corporate responsibility, and Miranda has made accusations, Liz has just trudged on, putting up with it all. Even though under her self-effacing manner, I'm sure she was as scared as anyone. My ankle throbs as I force myself to standing, and I begin to move aside the sofa cushions, ready to pull out the mattress hidden inside the frame. But as I pick up the last cushion, I see something lying underneath it, right where Liz and I were sitting. It glitters in the firelight, and for a second I think it's a brooch or a piece of jewellery. But when I pick it up, I realise it's a key. A very familiar one. It's a staff key. Automatically, I feel in my pocket, assuming it must have slid out of my jeans when I sat down, but mine is still there, hard and reassuring against my backside. Only, it's not reassuring at all. Because if my key is in my pocket, it means... Oh, God. It means this is Danny's key. Danny's key that was stolen. The key that was taken by the killer. I stand there for a very long time, completely frozen, just looking down at the key in the palm of my hand and trying to cudgel my brain into figuring this out. Somehow, someone got hold of this key, probably during the kerfuffle over getting entry to Tiger's room after Inigo's disappearance. It's not hard to imagine someone slipping it surreptitiously out of the lock while we were all preoccupied with checking Tiger was okay. Whoever took it used it to gain entry to that same room in the middle of the night and kill Annie. And then at some point after that, presumably this morning, while we were all distracted by talking about the plan to ski down to the village, it slipped out of their pocket and fell between the sofa cushions. The only question is, who took it? Who was sitting on that space on the sofa this morning? Because I cannot for the life of me remember. I shut my eyes, trying to picture the scene. Tiger lying on the sofa, sobbing, Miranda trying to comfort her, Rick handing out whiskies. I need to place all the characters in the room one by one, figure this out. Danny and I were standing, I remember that clearly. Topher was leaning up against the mantelpiece. Miranda was kneeling on the floor by the coffee table. Liz was in one of the armchairs by the fire. Rick and Carl, they were on a sofa, but which one? I squeeze my eyes shut harder and have a sudden vision of Rick leaning forward, filling up the whiskey glass at the far end of the table. It was the other sofa, the one beneath the window, which means I open my eyes. It means Tiger was lying on the sofa where I found the key, her hip right on the point where the cushions join. It would make complete sense. The key could so easily have slid out of her pocket while she was lying there crying. Except, it makes no sense at all. Tiger is the only person who didn't need a key to kill Annie. She was already in the room. And if she wanted an alibi, she could have simply said she forgot to lock the door. But no one else occupied that seat after the key went missing apart from me.
And Liz. As if hypnotized, my gaze drifts upwards to the ceiling, where on the floor above, Liz is moving around her room, gathering up duvets and pillows. I can hear the faint creak of the floor joists, and then the sound of her door shutting. I hear the shush, shush, as she drags the duvet along the corridor. Then I hear the halting noise of her feet on the spiral stairs, going carefully this time, she does not want to slip again. Then she appears in the doorway of the living room, her hands full of bed covers, her face unreadable in the dim light, the firelight flickering off her big, owl-like glasses. And with a funny little pang, I remember that very first day, the way she reminded me of an owl, paralysed by the lights of an oncoming car. She still looks like an owl, but suddenly the resemblance seems very different. And quite another kind of chill comes over me, as I realise I was right all along. But so very, very wrong. Because here is the thing. We think we know owls. They are the soft, friendly, blinking creatures of children's rhymes and stories. They may be wise, but they are also slow and easily confused. The problem is, none of that is true. Owls are not slow. They are fast, lightning fast. And they are not confused. In their own element, the dark, they are swift and merciless hunters. Owls are raptors, predators. That was what I saw in Liz right back on that very first day. I was just too blinded by my own preconceptions to recognise it. In the dark, owls are not the hunted, but the hunter. And right now, it is dark.
Hi,
Liz says, and she smiles, an unreadable smile behind those blank, flickering lenses.
Are you all right?
Liz. Snoop ID, Anon 101. Listening to, offline. Snoop Scribers, 1.
When I come back down, my arms full of duvets and pillows, Erin is standing stock still in the middle of the room, one hand on the sofa bed frame, as if a thought has just occurred to her.
Hi,
I say. I throw the bedding into the armchair. Then, when she still doesn't move, I add,
are you all right?
I don't know why I say that, except that she looks really odd.
Is the sofa bed stuck?
What? She seems to shake herself. Then she gives a smile and a short laugh.
No, sorry. Just thinking. I was thinking about Danny. They must be there by now. I was wondering if we'd hear from them tonight.
I glance up at the clock on the mantelpiece. It is so dark now that the hands are almost unreadable, but I think I can make out that it's nearly 8 o'clock. I guess you're right. How long did you say it would take to get there?
I thought about 3 hours. But given Miranda and Carl have never snowshoed before, it might take longer. Still, they left just after one. Even allowing for rests and stuff, they ought to be at Haute Montagne easily by now. Maybe even on their way back, though I don't know if they'll snowshoe in the dark.
She gives the metal frame a tug. The sofa bed unfurls with a screech. I hope you're right. I move my pillows onto the mattress and then help Erin take the cushions off the other sofa and unfold the bed. Losing the water feels like the last straw.
We'll have to melt snow,
Erin says. Her face looks white and strained in the dim light, but it's not surprising, really.
I can't believe it's only been 2 days since the avalanche. It feels like forever.
2 days? For a second, I don't believe her, and then I count up in my head, and I realise she's right. 2 days and 4 hours. It feels like a lifetime ago. It does feel like we've been trapped here forever. And now, it is almost over. The strange thing is, I'm not sure I'm ready to face reality again. It is just dawning on me that what felt like captivity might actually be a kind of idyllic tranquility. Père Saint-Neige is a crime scene, and we are suspects. When we get back to the real world, we are going to have to face the full glare of publicity. There will be a police investigation, reporters, news stories, interviews. I can see the headlines now. Chalet of Death. All sorts of things are going to come out of the woodwork. Now it is my turn to stand stock still, staring into the darkness, thinking. I'll go and get my bedding, Erin says into the silence. Can you put another log in the stove? Sure, I say, shaking myself back to the here and now. I watch her as she picks up a torch and passes through into the lobby, the thin beam spiralling around as she makes her way up the stairs, her hand going click, click, click on the banister as something hard, a ring perhaps, strikes against the metal. Click, click, click. I hear again my mother's breathless, nervous. Oh, Liz, you know Daddy doesn't like that. Tick, tick, tick. Disappearing into the darkness. Perhaps it is the thought of the police and everything that is going to come crashing down, but suddenly, I don't know why, it sounds like a clock ticking down to zero.
Erin, Snoop ID, Little Mai, listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers, 10.
My heart is hammering as I walk along the corridor to the staff section and let myself into my bedroom. The room is totally dark, lit only by the narrow beam of the torch, but I don't want to risk the batteries giving way, so I switch it off. And in the darkness, I sink down onto my bed. I need to think. My fist is clenched around the key, hard against my palm, like a physical reminder of the craziness of this situation. And now, as I sit there trying desperately to make myself understand this conundrum, I find that I'm holding it so hard that it's biting into my fingers, leaving dents I can still feel when I force my hand open. What does it mean? What does it mean? If Liz took that key, is she the killer? But how? I cast my mind back, reliving the scrum in the corridor when Danny broke into Tiger's room. Liz was there, I'm certain. But I remember that while everyone else surged forward into the room, she hung back. I thought at the time it was because of her natural reserve. It seemed so in character compared to the way everyone else thrust themselves forwards, pushing to see what was going on. But now I wonder. Was she hanging back so that she could pocket the key unobserved? But why? That's what I can't understand. Liz cannot have killed Ava. Motive aside, she's one of the few people, along with Annie and Carl, who had no opportunity at all. She was stuck on the bubble lift going back down to the bottom of Blanche-Neige when Ava was seen skiing La Sorcière. But the key. The key that is hard and jagged and incontrovertible in my hand, as if refusing to allow me to forget its evidence. What about the key? I rub my hand over my face, feeling the shiny scar tissue, the ever-present reminder of what I did, the price I paid for being too sure of myself. And I'm suddenly aware that I have been sitting here for, I'm not sure how long, but a long time. Too long. Suspiciously long. I have to get back downstairs or Liz will know something is wrong. I switch the torch back on and gather up an armful of duvets and then, holding the torch in my teeth, balanced on top of the stack of pillows, I open the door with my free hand. Liz is standing right outside, almost nose to nose with me, the torchlight reflecting off her glasses. I scream and the torch bounces off the pillows and falls to the floor with a thump where it goes out. My heart is hammering in my chest like a pneumatic drill. Jesus, I manage, my voice shaking. Liz, you scared me. I set the duvets down with trembling hands and grope for the torch.
Sorry,
she says. It sounds like she's smiling, but I can't be sure in the darkness. There is something so flat about her voice, so hard to read.
It took so long. I got worried.
Oh, fuck. What can I say? What excuse can I give? I was just changing my top. What? Why on earth did I say this? She'll be able to see I'm wearing the same clothes I was before. What a stupid lie. I feel sick with nerves. I am a terrible liar. Even at school, I could never do the two-faced, oh, you look so lovely, I look like trash thing that the other girls did. The only time I can dissemble is when I'm in staff mode. Then I'm polite and cheerful to everyone, no matter how I really feel. Not because I like them, but because they are guests, and I'm staff, and that's my job. The thought calms me. It's my job. I can do this. Liz is a guest, and it's my job to be sympathetic to her. I just have to channel that thought. I switch on the torch, and I make myself smile. Should we head down? It's really cold up here. And Liz nods and turns for the stairs.
Liz, Snoop ID Anon 101, listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers 1.
There is something wrong with Erin. I'm not sure what. She said she was worried about Danny, but if that's the case, I don't know why her fears came on so suddenly. She was quite cheerful until about 2 hours ago. Then she got nervous and edgy. We have been lying in the darkness for perhaps an hour or more, but she is not asleep.
It's not just that she's not snoring. Out of the corner of my gaze, I can see her eyes are still open, reflecting the light from the fire's embers as she blinks. She is lying there, in the darkness, silently watching me. She is thinking about something, but I do not know what. What is she thinking? I squeeze my eyes shut, trying to look as normal as possible. A few minutes later, I hear the creak of the mattress springs. Erin is cautiously swinging her legs out of bed.
"Where are you going?" I ask.
She jumps like a criminal caught in the middle of something and puts her hand to her heart.
"God! Liz, you scared me!"
"Sorry."
I don't say anything else. From my experience, if you keep quiet, people get nervous, they talk, they fill the silence with their own conversation. You can find out a lot that way. Sure enough, after a pause, Erin answers my question without me having to restate it.
I didn't mean to wake you. I couldn't sleep. I'm going to the toilet.
She is shivering. I can hear her teeth beginning to chatter. It is very, very cold in the room now. The fire has died down to glowing ash.
"Okay."
I roll over, pulling the covers up to my chin.
"Don't forget the pipes are frozen."
I know.
She opens the stove to put in another log.
"I'll use one of the upstairs bathrooms. I think we flushed both the downstairs loos already."
I don't say anything. I just watch her as she wraps her coat more tightly around her and then pads up the stairs. Then I turn over and feel in my pocket for the key. It is gone.
Erin. Snoop ID Little Mai. Listening to Offline. Snoop Scribers 10.
Bloody hell. My heart is pounding as I tiptoe up the staircase. I don't know where that lie about the toilets came from, but I've never been so thankful for frozen pipes. They have given me exactly what I needed, an excuse to go upstairs. I have no idea what the truth is about the key. Did Liz take it? I don't dare to ask. Maybe someone else sat on that sofa when I wasn't around. Or maybe Liz found the key and picked it up, but has been too scared to tell anyone in case they suspected her. There could be a dozen innocent explanations. Or there could be one very damning one. Either way, I could not lie there in the darkness listening to her soft, regular breathing a second more. I had to do something. And at last, my subconscious overrode my racing thoughts to prod me about something I had totally forgotten. Elliot's charging block. The giant external battery he was using to power his laptop before he died and his computer was destroyed. If I can get to that battery and plug my dead phone in, maybe I can get a sliver of connection. It's worth a try. It's also not something Liz could possibly object to. And yet, for reasons I can't face examining, I don't want to tell her.
Why not? My brain whispers as I tiptoe along the corridor in time with my steps. Why not? Because I don't trust her. Why not?
Because I swallow, hearing the dry click of my jaw in the eerie silence. Because in my heart of hearts, I do think she could have killed Ava. I don't know how,
but my fear over these last 2 hours has shown me something I would not have believed before tonight. I do think Liz has it in her to kill. It's not just the key, though that is concerning enough. The panic I felt when I opened the door of my room and saw her standing there smiling blankly at me, her face hidden behind those silvery lenses. There was something deep and true and real about that panic. It told me something I had not admitted to myself before. I am afraid of Liz. She may be meek and quiet and almost painfully reserved, but behind that meekness, I believe there is steel. And yes, I think she could kill someone. I believe that in a way that I never believed it of Inigo or even Topher, despite all the evidence piled up against him. Out of everyone here, I believe Liz could kill in cold blood and conceal that fact from us all. No one pays attention to her. And for a killer, that's a kind of superpower. I am almost at Elliot's door. I am walking as silently as I can now, remembering the way Liz's steps along the corridor were audible in the room below. I take the passkeys out of my pocket, and choosing one, I insert it gently into the lock, turn it, and open Elliot's door very, very quietly. It creaks just a little bit, and I hold my breath, hoping Liz didn't hear. But there is no sound from below. If she came up, I would have no excuse for being down this end of the building. The natural thing would be for me to use the staff bathroom up the far end, or, if I couldn't be bothered to walk that far, to access one of the guest bedrooms closer to the stairs. Not Elliot's. Not a room with a... The smell hits me as I open the door. It's a smell I remember from the teaching hospital. There is a dead body in this room. Beneath the reek of urine and the incongruously homely smell of spilled coffee, it smells of death. Not badly, the room is too cold for that, but unmistakably. A fetid, animal kind of smell. There is no way you would choose to use this room for anything if you had another option. The smell makes me gag, but I push the urge down and edge across the room to the far side of Elliot's desk. And there it is, sitting like a breeze block on the floor, a single red LED piercing the gloom. My heart gives a thump of relief. And almost at the same time, I notice two things. The first is that a phone is plugged into the charging block and it's switched on and fully charged. Elliot left his phone charging. Of course he did. But the second thing I see is that he has an Android and mine is an iPhone. My phone is in my pocket, but I can't use his charger. I want to kick myself. I should have collected my own charger first. That was incredibly stupid of me. Do I have time? Ordinarily, it would take me less than a minute to run to the other end of the corridor, slam through the staff doors, and grab my charger from beside my bed. But now, I can't run. I can't slam through the doors. I can't afford to make a sound. I make up my mind. I will try Elliot's phone first. You can dial some emergency numbers from the lock screen. I just have no idea whether 112 or 17 are among them. I pick it up, and the screen jumps into life. But with a lurch of disappointment, I see there is still no reception. Just an X by the greyed-out scale. I can't call anyone. Still, there are a bunch of app notifications on the lock screen, and it's with a flicker of hope that I scroll down them trying to figure out if the phone has connected at all during the past 24 hours. If it's getting even tiny blips of reception, that might be enough. If I can get into the phone, I could send a text which would just sit there in the outbox until the phone connected. I wouldn't have to do anything, just wait for it to send. And there it is. A WhatsApp from 6 hours ago. And below that, a notification from Snoop. Anon 101 is geo-close. Whatever that means. Geo-close? I've never had a notification like that on my Snoop account. I have no time to worry about that now, though. The question is how I get into the phone. I have 3 tries before it locks out, and then I'll have no choice but to go back and get my charger and wait while my own phone powers up, which will take long enough to make Liz wonder where I am. I'm racking my brains, trying to remember if Kate ever told me Elliot's date of birth, and if so, whether to try the year or the day and month. But when I bring up the lock screen, I come up short. It's not a pin pad. It's a thumb scanner. My stomach drops with disappointment. But then I realise what this means. And I experience a different kind of lurch. This one of nauseated horror. As it dawns on me what I have to do next. Oh, God. Can I do it? And if I can, what kind of person does that make me? I glance across at the desk. I force myself to look at the shape I have been trying to ignore. Let my eyes skitter across. Elliot. Elliot's body. His hand is stretched out across the desk, and I feel my cheeks go hot, and then cold, and then hot again with a kind of deep, piercing shame at what I am about to do. But I have to get inside that phone. I stand up, I unplug the phone from the block, and I take a step across the room, closer to where Elliot is sprawled. And then another. And then I am standing by his desk, reaching for his hand, his cold, firm hand. It is a little clammy, though that is mostly due to how cold the room is, and his arm is surprisingly heavy to manoeuvre. But the rigour has worn off, and it is without too much difficulty that I unfurl his fingers and hold his long, bony thumb between mine, chill and firm as a joint of meat. "I'm sorry," I whisper to him. "I'm so, so sorry." And then I press the tip against the lock screen. For a minute, nothing happens, and I feel a piercing, shooting sense of disappointment. Can the phone somehow tell? Does it work off body warmth? Does it know that this is a dead man, not a living owner? There is only one way to find out. Feeling even sicker, I put down the phone and rub the cold, clammy tip of Elliot's thumb between my palms, chafing it roughly, trying to get a little of my own body heat into Elliot's skin. It's surprisingly hard. My hands are cold too, and for a long time all I can feel is the bone-deep chill of dead flesh against mine. But I persist, huffing on his thumb to try and warm him with my breath. And at last, there does seem to be some perceptible difference in temperature. Before it can dissipate, I pick up the phone and press it quickly against the tip, holding my breath. And then, The display lights up with the hot pink of the Snoop app's home screen. And I'm inside Elliot's phone. I'm about to minimize Snoop and navigate to the text message app when I stop. There is something really odd about Elliot's Snoop app. He is being followed by 1.2 million people, which is not that surprising, I guess. He's known to be one of the co-founders of the company and his Snoop ID is public. But the weird thing is that he's following only two people. One of them is Topher. I remember his avatar and ID from when I followed him myself. Extopher, and a photo of him balancing a spoon on his nose with a little tick to show he's verified. Snooping Extopher for 3 years, says the text beside his name. That's not the weird part. The weird part is that the other person he subscribed to is a totally anonymous user, Anon101. Anon has no picture, and when I click on the blank space where their avatar would have been to take me through to their profile, there is nothing in their bio either. Go away is the only line they've put in the About field, which maybe explains why they have only one follower. That's it. But under Location, there is an entry. A string of GPS coordinates and a tiny logo saying Beta in brackets. This must be the update Elliot was working on before he died. The geo-snooping update that he and Topher were so excited about. The one that let them locate Ava. But who is Anon101, and why is Elliot following them? Is Anon Ava? But no, that's ridiculous. Not with one follower. And besides, I've snooped Ava. I can't remember what her ID was, but I remember her avatar, a snow leopard wearing Ray-Bans. I click back to the previous screen. Snooping Anon101 for 2 days. Says the text beside their name. Elliot followed Anon101 right before he died. My stomach is fluttering now, and my thumb hovers above the GeoSnoop beta tab at the top of the menu. I remember that notification on the home screen now, the notification that I swiped aside so carelessly. Anon101 is geo-close. I press the geo-snoop tab. In your area, says the text at the top of the menu. And then, underneath, there is a list of just two people. Little Mai, Anon101. I am Little Mai. Which means Anon101 must be Liz.
Liz. Snoop ID Anon101. Listening to Offline. Snoopscribers 1.
There is something wrong. Erin has not come back from her trip to the toilet. She has been gone a long time, but more than that, I can't hear anything at all. No doors opening, no footsteps on the stairs, no sound of water flushing. Has something happened? Has she fallen asleep? I lie there, chewing my lip, trying to work out what to do. I went after her last time. I was worried when she took so long over changing her top. But now I am not sure if that was a good idea. The panic on her face when she opened the bedroom door and saw me standing there, just about to knock, made me think I had made a mistake. And now I wonder, is that when her manner changed? Maybe she is frightened of me. Perhaps she thinks I'm a stalker.
People have a habit of pulling away from me. It is something I have noticed over the years. It started with the girls at school. They would be friendly at first, and I'd try to make overtures back, and then they would start to call for reasons I could never put my finger on. So I would try harder, make more effort. But the more I tried, the more they seemed to grow cold, until at last everything I did just seemed to make them hate me more. At primary school, the other girls weren't subtle about it. "Go away, Liz, you're so weird." I heard it again and again. As we got older, the girls in my class pretended to be kinder, but underneath they were thinking the same things beneath their, "Oh, so sorry, we're saving this seat," or, "My mum says I can only have three girls to the sleepover, really sorry, Liz." The girls were bad. The boys were worse. The worst of all was Kevin. Even his name makes me shudder. I liked Kevin. I thought that he might like me too. He had acne and his breath was a little stale and he wasn't particularly handsome. He didn't seem as unattainable as some of the other boys. I got a book out of the library on how to make boys like you, but it was confusing and contradictory. "Laugh at his jokes," it said, so I did. But then Kevin would look at me as if I were crazy and say, "What are you laughing at?" "Give him something to remind him of you." I gave him a pair of mittens I had knitted. I left them in his locker, but he never wore them. Later, I found them in lost property. Engineer chance meetings. I followed him around. I made sure I was there, leaning against the lockers when he came out of the boys' toilets. I waited by his bus stop. One day, I followed him home. It was November and almost dusk. I didn't think he had noticed me, but he had. We had walked nearly 2 miles when he turned on me. "What do you want, you fucking weirdo?" he said, his voice cracking and breaking on the last word. Only he didn't say it. He came right up into my face and screamed it. I could smell his stale breath and feel his spit hitting me as he shouted. It was dark. Rain had begun to fall. We were in a lonely part of the park. A small part of me wanted to kill him. But I didn't. Instead, I cowered away from him, cringing from his anger. And then, when he pushed me and yelled, "Are you fucking desperate or what?" I ran. I was crying and shaking. By the time I was hired at Snoop, I had learned my lesson. I kept myself to myself. I didn't try to make friends. I didn't trust anyone. But Erin, somehow Erin seemed different. She was so friendly when we first arrived. I remember her sympathy when I asked her advice about the dress code. Her kindness as she towed me to the ski lift that first day. She really seemed to like me. Now, I am not so sure. What if she was pretending all along? I want to go up there and ask her what she thinks of me, whether she is scared of me, what she's doing up there in the dark. But I don't know how she would feel about that. Maybe I could say I was worried about her. After all, 3 people have died. It's what a good friend would do. Look out for her. Check she was okay. But would she see it that way? Would she know I was just being a good friend? Or would she give me that look again? That panicked, terrified look that I saw in Kevin's eyes when he turned on me. The one I saw in Erin's eyes when she opened the door last time. The look that says, "You weirdo." The look that says, "I'm scared." I am still dithering 10 minutes later. At last, I can't take the silence anymore. I have to know what she is doing. I swing my legs out of bed and stand up. I'm still wearing my ski suit, so I'm not that cold. My knee still hurts, but I can put my weight on it now. Really, I am very glad not to be snowshoeing to the other chalet. I mean, I would never have fallen down the stairs deliberately. That would be a really stupid idea. I could have been killed. But it worked out well. Still, I go carefully on the stairs, holding the handrail. The wood is slippy beneath my socks. The treads themselves are hard to see in the darkness, and I definitely don't want another fall. At the top of the stairs, I pause, holding my breath, trying to listen. Where is she? In the staff quarters? I'm just about to turn left to see if she's down that end of the corridor when I hear a noise. It's a very slight one, but it is coming from the opposite direction, from the direction of the corridor that holds Miranda's, Elliot's, and my room. What would she be doing down there? But before I can find out, I hear another noise from the same direction, this time unmistakable. It's the sound of a toilet flushing. The door to Miranda's room opens and Erin comes out. She doesn't look that surprised to see me this time. Instead, she just smiles. "Hi, Liz." Her voice is slightly breathless. "Sorry, were you worried?" "A bit," I frown at her. "What were you doing in Miranda's room?" "I already flushed the staff toilet. I didn't think Miranda would mind, and it was the closest. Liz, fair warning." It's hard to tell in the darkness, but it looks like her face is a bit flushed. "Sorry, this is TMI, but I had a bit of an upset stomach. Think maybe the cassoulet wasn't heated through properly. That's why it took me a bit longer." "Oh, I'm not sure what to say to that. Should I laugh? No, that would seem strange." I arrange my features into what I hope is a sympathetic smile. Then I worry that it might just look like a smile, so I frown instead. "Oh, gosh, poor you. I realise you probably didn't want to know that, but I thought I should warn you in case, well, I mean, we had the same supper." "Oh, I've been fine," I say hastily. It's the truth. I haven't had so much as a twinge, but then I've always had a really good digestion. "Oh, good," she says. There's relief in her face.
"I'd hate to have given you food poisoning on top of everything else."
She gives a shaky laugh and then says, "Well, shall we?" For a minute, I'm not sure what she's referring to, but then she nods at the stairs and I understand what she's saying. "Sure," I say, but then something stops me. "Actually, you head down. I need the toilet as well." She nods and begins to limp her way down the spiral staircase. I watch her go for a moment, and then I head down the corridor towards my own room. I unlock the door and slip inside, and go over to the built-in closet in the corner of my room. The door is ajar, which is how I left it, but is it my imagination, or is it very slightly wider than it was before?
I stand stock still for a long moment looking at the door. It's cracked open maybe 2 inches. It looks like a lot. It looks like a wider gap than before, but I can't be sure. Making up my mind, I open the door and pull out my suitcase, and then I unzip the lining. Inside, pressed flat against the base of the suitcase, behind the silky lining and a piece of card, should be a scarlet ski jacket. It's too dark to really see, and I left my torch downstairs, but when I poke my fingers through the narrow gap, I can feel it is there, its downy softness reassuring. I let out a sigh of relief and sit back on my heels. Then I zip up the lining and replace the case inside the cupboard, and I stand painfully and go through to the bathroom. I might as well make my story convincing while I'm here. But it's only when I'm halfway through peeling off my ski suit that something strikes me. Something that stops me in my tracks. That suitcase was on top of the stack, on top of my little wheelie cabin bag. I left it the other way around. I'm absolutely certain of it. Someone has been inside my closet. Erin? Or someone else? My heart is thumping. Slowly, very slowly, I pull up the zip of my jumpsuit, thinking hard, trying to figure out what to do. Then I flush the toilet and walk back downstairs to try to figure out how much Erin knows.
Erin, Snoop ID Little Mai, listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers 10. From up above, I hear Liz's toilet flush. And I hunker down underneath the duvet, hoping I can pretend to be asleep when she comes back. My mind is racing, trying to figure out what can possibly have happened. Thank God I heard her coming up the stairs and was able to leave Elliot's room and nip 2 doors down to Miranda's. If she had found me coming out of Elliot's, I would have had to come clean. And the truth is, I am much too scared to do that. What the hell does it all mean? Is Liz the killer? But how? Never mind motive, she has a cast-iron alibi. She was on the bubble lift going down the valley when Ava was killed. Except no one actually saw her get on the lift. I try to think back to that final run down the mountain as everyone described it. Ava was coming up in the Ren bubble lift. Carl had fallen over at the bottom trying to get on, and Annie was helping him. Everyone else standing at the top of the blue run, Blanche-Neige, huddled in the screaming wind, waiting for Ava, Carl, and Annie to arrive. Then came Liz's refusal to ski, and Topher's bullying attempt to force her to do it. Everyone agreed what happened next. Liz tore off her skis and walked back up the slope to the lift to get on the bubble back down to the chalet. But what if she hadn't? What if she had gone through the little shack housing the lift and straight out the other side towards the black run? La Sorcière. Then, at the top of the run, right by the steepest part of the piste, she stood and waited. I try to imagine how Liz could have lured Ava across. Maybe she pretended she had slid helplessly down the black run, towards the sheer drop. Maybe she faked a problem with her boot or her ski. Either way, she must have called to Ava, and then, when Ava was very close to her and off guard, she pushed her off the precipice. That would have been the riskiest part. Not the risk of being seen. The visibility was too bad for that, and the lift building would have been between them and the skiers standing on Blanche-Neige. But the risk of failing to push Ava over the edge. If Ava had managed to save herself, or worse, if she had grabbed hold of her attacker and taken her over the edge as well, everything would have been finished. But it worked. It must have done. And now Liz just had to give herself an alibi by ensuring that Ava was seen to be safe and well after Liz was supposed to have gone back down in the lift. I remember that huge, bulky ski suit, the way Liz was sweating, just standing around at the base of the lift. I even remember thinking that she was clearly wearing far too many layers and wondering why on such a nice day. Now I know why. It wasn't inexperience at all. It was planned. It would not have been very hard to have a second ski jacket on underneath the first. It would have taken seconds to unzip the baggy blue jumpsuit, take off the scarlet ski jacket beneath, and put it on over the top. With her helmet, goggles and dark-coloured ski pants, anyone seeing her at a distance would take it for granted that she was Ava. And so she set off to ski La Saussière, stopping just to make sure that one person at least, faithful little Annie, far above her in the bubble lift, would be able to back up her story. I think of Annie's last words to Tiger, her puzzled, "I didn't see her." We all thought she was talking about Ava. But what if? What if she were talking about Liz? Liz, who was supposed to be on the bubble going down the mountain at the same time Annie was coming up. What if that was what Annie realised? That Liz never passed them going back down? That she never took the lift at all? It is plausible. It is all horribly plausible. And it would very likely have worked if it weren't for one thing. Elliot's geo-snooping app, covertly gathering data on everyone in the party. Because Elliot wasn't stupid. As soon as he figured out that Ava had died, he would have looked at the movements of everyone else on the mountain that day. He would have known that the person who skied La Saussière was not Ava, but a non-101. Only, even with all the info at his disposal, he could not be certain who a non-101 was. So he followed Anon on Snoop, and he set about figuring it out by process of elimination. But he was killed before he could share his suspicions with Topher. This theory explains almost everything. It explains why Elliot had to die, why his computer with all the geo-snooping data was smashed up. It explains why Annie was killed. There's only one thing it doesn't explain. Why? Why Ava was killed in the first place? Because Liz still doesn't have a motive. Still, I remember Danny's words. "I dunno, we could probably give them all motives if we needed to." He's right. Alibi is the key, not motive. And I have just smashed Liz's alibi to pieces. There is just one problem. If I'm right, that fact puts me next in line to be killed. I am alone in an isolated chalet with a murderer. And there's nothing I can do. Liz, Snoop ID Anon 101, listening to offline, Snoop Scribers
1. Who moved my suitcase? The question gnaws at me like a rat as I walk slowly back downstairs. When I enter the living room, I can see Erin is huddled under the duvet. Her eyes are closed and she's breathing softly and rhythmically. But it seems to me, and I can't tell if I'm being paranoid here, that there is something a little fake about the way she is lying. Does anyone really look that composed in sleep? Erin, I whisper very softly. She stirs, her eyelids flickering momentarily, but she doesn't appear to wake. I sit on the sofa bed beside her and try to think. I am completely sure about the suitcase. At least, I think I am. But I have not looked in that cupboard since Sunday. Anyone could have moved my case. Even if they moved it, that doesn't mean they looked inside the lining. It could have been Elliot, gathering information before he took his suspicions to Topher. It could even have been something completely innocent. I could kill Erin. That is not the issue. I could put a pillow over her face, just like I did with Annie. But here is the problem. If I kill Erin, everyone will know it was me. There is no one here for miles around. I would have no hope of persuading anyone that an unknown intruder broke in and smothered her in her sleep. I killed Elliot and Annie because I had to. I acted quickly on the spur of the moment, working with what I had to hand. With Elliot, that was Ava's sleeping pills, crushed into a cup of black coffee. He never suspected a thing when I offered him a refill. I guess that's all I ever was to him. Someone to fetch the coffee. For Annie, it was her own pillow pressed over her nose and mouth. She died quietly, her struggles muffled by the thick duvet wrapped around her. I felt, well, I would like to say that I felt guilty for them both, but the truth is I didn't, really. Elliot brought it on himself with his snooping and his prying. I did feel sorry for Annie, but she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. What I saw in her eyes when she stood frozen in my doorway that night was the sudden realization of what she had seen, what she had not seen. The empty glass spheres of the bubble lift, returning back down to the station when one of them should have contained me. She realised what it meant. I could tell that straight away from the moment our eyes locked and hers filled with sudden fear. She hurried back to her room, locking the door behind her. She probably felt safe. She didn't know I had a passkey. But I don't feel guilty, even about Annie, because it's not my fault, any of this. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, too. I never asked for any of this. I was caught up in something I couldn't help. Caught up in Topher and Ava's own personal Game of Thrones. Not even one of the major players, just a pawn for Ava to play against Topher when the time was right. My own past leveraged against me. Because here's the thing. I am a good person. I never wanted any of this. I certainly don't want to kill anyone if I don't have to. If Erin didn't look inside that case, if she hasn't figured this out, well, I don't want to hurt her. I don't need to act quickly. I have time to think about this. There is no way help can get here before morning.
I can take my time to work out if she knows something, and if so, what I can do about it. It would have to be an accident, or look like an accident. Another slip on the stairs, maybe. A carbon monoxide leak with the stove. Though I'm not sure how I would engineer that. Slowly, I take off my glasses and lie down. But I don't shut my eyes. I lie there, facing Erin, watching her. Watching her sleep.
Erin. Snoop ID, Little Mai. Listening to, offline, Snoopscribers, 10.